Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair OMFIF. Today, OMFIF and I have the great pleasure of welcoming back one of my former colleagues, Fabio Natalucci. Fabio is responsible for producing the fund's excellent semi-annual Global Financial Stability Report. In his role as Deputy Director of the Monetary and Capital Markets Department of the IMF, prior to joining the fund, Fabio was a Senior Associate Director in the Division of Monetary Affairs at the Federal Reserve Board, and for about a year, he was also Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Financial Stability and Regulation at the U.S. Department of Treasury, where he oversaw the U.S. role in the Financial Stability Board and the international regulatory reform agenda more generally. Welcome, Fabio. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark. It's always a pleasure to discuss about financial markets with OMFIS. So thanks for the invitation. So maybe what I'll do quickly a very short summary of the Global Financial Stability Report, main bullet points, and then walk you through a brochure that we have produced that should represent and summarize the Financial Stability Report. Now, global financial market condition have clearly tightened abruptly, very sharply, suddenly, with the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic starting early in the year. We have seen risk asset prices dropping sharply at an unprecedented speed as investors have rushed for safety and liquidity of sovereign debt. Emerging markets and frontier markets have faced a perfect storm, have experienced record portfolio flows reversal at the trough, north of $100 billion or 0.4 GDP of emerging markets, which is much larger than what we saw during the financial crisis. And so looking forward, in terms of vulnerabilities and possible risk, the concern is that a further tightening of financial condition could expose financial vulnerabilities. And those include asset manager, for example, may become distressed sellers, thus exacerbating price declines. We could see leverage firms losing market access and default spiking in credit markets. Also concern about the fact that bank resilience may be tested as economic and financial markets rise, stress rise. And so the call is for strong policy response and international cooperation needed to tackle these challenges. That's a quick summary, if you want, of the report. The first chart in the brochure shows you that there is a precipitous fall in risky asset prices. So if we look at, for example, equities, and we compare the decline in equity prices in the major equity markets, so euro area, Japan, S&P 500 for the US or emerging markets, peak to trough, so from January 17 through the second half of March, we can see that we have declines that are half or more of what we saw during the global financial crisis in 2007 and 2008. Of course, there are sectors that have been more hardly hit. Those are, for example, airlines, hotel, restaurant, anything that has been exposed to the lockdown of the global economy. And then there's been a second shock in some sense. When OPEC Plus did not reach an agreement on oil production, we have seen the energy sector being hit particularly hard, and that we have seen, in fact, development in oil prices in the past few days, where oil prices have collapsed. Now, the same picture you can get if you look at corporate spreads. In some cases, we have seen a widening of corporate spreads in terms of changes that are actually greater than what we saw during the financial crisis. That's true particularly for the sub-investment grade, and it's generally true across jurisdictions and geographies. And of course, the impact has been cushioned by the policy response of central banks, fiscal policy. So we have seen a sharp decline, particularly in the US, of the 10-year treasury yield, part reflecting expectation of a downward shift in the path of expected monetary policy, but also a contraction narrowing in risk premia, in term premia, even more deeply negative as investors, as I said, rush for the liquidity and safety of treasury securities. Now, there's been a number of factors that have amplified the sharp decline in asset prices. The report focused on a few of them, so I'm just going to mention them briefly. Of course, one has been the corporate credit sector came into this episode very highly leveraged with a number of vulnerabilities that we have stressed and emphasized in past reports, including poor underwriting standard, a loosening of investor protection, high leverage, very tight corporate spreads, even when adjusted by turn of leverage. And so we have seen the widening of credit spreads and decline in leveraged loan prices, for example, the latter about almost two-thirds of what we have seen during the GFC. The difference is that it took a year and a half or 2 years there to get to the trough. Here, it only took about 2 months. And so there's expectation that the default rate will rise. And in fact, a number of rating agencies have come out with estimates that they're approaching a recession level. That was one factor. Another factor that amplified asset price move has been the complete freezing of short-term funding markets. And that's true across looking at different spreads in different markets, in CP market, it was true in the muni market. And in some sense, as prime money funds start seeing and in expectation of outflows, they start selling assets into the short-term funding markets. Banks were unable to issue CP, so they tapped down on lines of credit. So you get a complete freezing, essentially, of short-term funding markets that required the Fed to step in. And that also translated into international global dollar markets, and we have seen a pretty sharp widening in cross-currency basis swap market. Now, the freezing of short-term funding markets and the international angle associated with that, it's something very reminiscent of the 2007-2008 crisis when shock originated in the US transmitted to global markets. So we've seen a repeat of that, and that in some sense it was only ameliorated and lessened by the very fast intervention by the Federal Reserve in the US with a number of instruments. And I'll come back to the intervention later. We've also seen an amplifier of the shock has been market illiquidity. We have seen very poor liquidity even in the market that it's by definition the deepest and most liquid market in global financial market, which is the US Treasury. Reportedly, a number of unwind of highly leveraged trade by hedge funds contribute to that. It's also the flip side of what we have discussed before in terms of the short-term funding markets freezing with dealer balance sheet clog. It's reverberated across a number of markets. It's a broader point about illiquidity. It's not just the U.S. Treasury market. We have a bunch of indicators. We follow the fund. They show deterioration in liquidity across asset classes and across geographies, so broader than that. But it was particularly noticeable that you've seen a diminishing of liquidity in the U.S. Treasury market. Now, that said, one difference between this episode, current episode, and 2007-2008 is that the decline of liquidity stress or the decline in price volatility has been much faster than what we saw 10 years ago, coupled with very sharp increase in trading volume. So in some sense, the market structure obviously has changed between 2007 and 2008. Today, that is reflected in the different response in some sense in terms of liquidity. Now, part of it is the very swift, bold, and timely response of central bank. Part of it, I think, it's also a result of reforms that have been put in place post-financial crisis. One example that we can point to is that a big chunk of activity is now centrally cleared, right? So if you look at like OTC interest rate derivative, CDS, now half or more than that in markets is actually centrally cleared. And that probably helped facilitate risk transfer compared to 10 years ago. And that's, I think it's an important point to keep in mind as we reassess the effectiveness of financial regulation. We have seen another factor that contributes to the sharp tightening of financial condition has been that we started from a point of very stretched valuation. That was true in equity markets globally, as well as in fixed income markets, particularly sub-investment grade. And then, of course, if the adjustment in terms of asset price has to come from a higher point, that becomes, again, another amplifier in terms of asset price, the speed of the asset price adjustment. And then finally, I mentioned briefly before, emerging markets, we have seen perfect storm for emerging markets, very large decline in equity prices, pretty much in line with what we've seen in advanced economies. We've seen depreciation of currencies, particularly for commodity-linked economies. They face a shock from the large decline in oil prices. And so one way to summarize all this is to look at spreads, very large widening of spreads in emerging markets, even more pronounced for frontiers economy, north of 1,000 basis points at the peak. And look at the share of, for example, countries trading more than distress, so more than 1,000 basis points, that number reached almost 25%. And I already mentioned flows, decline, the very large outflows in terms of scale through across geography, initially more pronounced in Asia, but also in other emerging economies, and initially more pronounced in equities, but also spread to bond portfolio flows, although those outflows have stabilized more recently. Now, one way to summarize all this is what we use financial conditioning. We have in-house indices that we use. And if you can see there that the tightening is broad-based, it's not just in advanced economies, it's not just US, it's not just the euro area, with the exception of China. But again, what is particularly peculiar and concerning here was not just the scale of the magnitude of the tightening, which was the size of 1.5-2 standard deviation, which is by itself very large, but also the speed that 1.5-2 standard deviation tightening financial condition materialized over a 2 months period. Why back 10 years ago, 2007, 2008, it took about 1.5-2 years to go from trough to peak. Now, we use then these financial conditions to map them into a probabilistic distribution of global GDP. So if you look at what is the distribution of global GDP 1 year from now and compare that distribution to what the distribution was 6 months ago when we issued the last financial stability report, there's a number of points to make. One is that clearly the distribution has shifted materially to the left. That reflects the fact that that distribution is centered around the world economic outlook, the WEO baseline. Right? So by itself, that constrains the distribution to move with the WEO forecast. But there's a number of changes in the distribution itself. And that's where, despite the constraints of being centered, so the mode being the WEO, then we let financial conditions speak for themselves and tell us what the distribution of the shape is. One point is the distribution is much more wide now. So that reflects high degree of uncertainty. Second point is that the distribution is much longer, so there's a much more pronounced tail. So if you compare, for example, the fifth percentile, so the threshold of the distribution that has a 5% of probability of occurring or once in 20 years event, that number went from about 2.5% of GDP growth, which meant back in October, there was a 5% probability that world GDP would be 2.5 or below. Now that fifth percentile shifted all the way down to -7.4%. There is a 5% probability of global growth next year materialize, having a print of less than 7.4. So that's a full 10 percentage point shift in the tail. The other important point, finally, is that if you look at the probability that, in fact, we have positive reading for GDP 12 months from now, that number is less than 5%. Essentially, the financial condition are telling, and so the view from markets is that there is essentially almost zero probability of having positive growth 12 months from now. Now, so we have the WEO forecast, and then the WEO also has a number of downside scenarios. There's three scenarios in the box. Right? So the question is, should the actual materialization of economic activity 12 months from now being more severe? So what if we get essentially a recession, a downturn that is more severe and lengthier than it's what now in the baseline? In that case, financial condition will probably tighten. And that tightening of financial condition, especially if it occurs at speed that we have experienced early this year, would mask a number of financial vulnerabilities that we have highlighted and that have been building in previous year of very low interest rate and very low volatility. So, of course, one concern is emerging markets, as I mentioned. Emerging markets compared to the 2007-2008 GFC, great financial crisis, they come into this episode with a number of vulnerabilities. One of them, they are much more levered. So considering both debt and private debt, they are more levered than they were. And it's accompanied also by the fact that the average rating is lower. So that's a lower credit rating. And there are a larger share of in emerging markets that is now related to energy, for example. And so that makes us more susceptible, as we have seen in the past few weeks, to a shock to commodity prices. The second vulnerability is the policy space. It's much more reduced now than it was 10 years ago. We have seen real interest rate in emerging markets lower. That means less policy space. You'd see also less fiscal policy space, both in terms of debt to GDP numbers, as well in structural fiscal position. And then finally, the role of foreign investor in terms of portfolio flows is much higher than it was 10 years ago. That exposes emerging markets much more to the changing global risk appetite globally. Another way to say that is that they're much more exposed in terms of external financing need to global risk appetite. Another concern that we have vulnerabilities, I already mentioned, has to do with credit markets, particularly the risky segment of credit markets. They have grown very fast over the last decade and now reach $9 trillion globally. That includes high yield market, leverage lending, as well as private debt. And so to the extent that the vulnerabilities have risen there, that market has not been tested in the sense that banks play a much smaller role here. Credit provision in this segment is much more reliant on non-bank financial intermediaries, and those are pretty much untested in terms of a recession. And they come into this episode with much higher vulnerabilities, as I mentioned. So higher leverage, lower investor protection, lower rating, and so on. So that would be an important sector to follow. And then we look at financial intermediaries and the abilities of some of these financial intermediaries to essentially support, if you want, the recovery. Are they essentially going to be shock absorber or they will be shock propagator? The expectation coming out, if you take into consideration of the reforms that have been put in place post-financial crisis, is that the financial sector will be able to absorb at least a portion of the shock and not become as a financial amplifier. And so We look at three types of financial institution. One is asset manager, and the extent to which as they face very large outflows, particularly in those segments where the underlying are less liquid, for example, loans, corporate bonds, especially when daily liquidity is provided, whether large outflows would force asset manager to go to the liquidity buffer, so cash, lines of credit, more liquid securities, and eventually be forced to sell forcibly asset and amplify asset price move. The second financial institution type that we looked at was insurance companies. Insurance companies traditionally have played a counter-cyclical role, which means at some point when asset price decline, they provide a floor to the decline in terms of like marginal bid. And so to the extent that they have increased in their portfolio exposure to risky segments like corporate bonds, to the extent that they suffer losses on their holdings, that may impair their ability to play counter-cyclically, also including their larger exposure to private equity and private debt segment. That's a topic that we covered in the last financial stability report. And then lastly, the behavior of banks. We know that banks have more capital in terms of like quantity of capital as well as quality of capital. They have been subject to a stress test. They have been subject to stricter financial regulation. So the expectation going into this is that, again, the banks will be able to absorb the shock and not become a shock propagator. Now, of course, there are concerns if you look at equity prices. We have seen declining equity prices on average of 35% for bank equities, but also in some jurisdictions all the way down to 60% or more. And so the extent to which those equity prices would reflect concern about, one, losses on their securities holdings. And again, I mentioned corporate bonds. Another example the report covers is CMBS. Commercial real estate is a sector that even the Fed has highlighted as one of the potential financial stability concerns. In terms of their lending portfolios, I mentioned that companies were taking down lines of credit. CRE is another example. Globally, banks account for between 50 and 70+ of the commercial real estate lending provided, as well as also like level of profitability. We have seen that profitability is a different degree of profitability across jurisdiction. And so the extent that some jurisdiction may enter into with weak profitability, they may become a weakness in itself. So to conclude, of course, we have seen a significant improvement in risk appetite in the past few weeks. That clearly reflects the swift, bold action taken by central banks. We have seen central banks stepping in along different lines. They stepped in by easing monetary policy, so lower rates all the way down to the zero lower bound when possible. We have seen them providing forward guidance and through asset purchases. So easing monetary policy, provision of liquidity to banks and markets, enhancement of swap lines by the Federal Reserve through not only through the standing swap lines, but also enhancing to a number of central banks that were included in the swap lines during the financial crisis. That including some emerging markets. And then third, the reactivation of crisis era, the Alphabet Soup facility. And you can think of those in some sense as an attempt to unclog the pipes through the plumbing of the financial system, and when not possible, bypassing the financial intermediaries and reaching directly the end user, so firms and households, with the intent of maintaining the flow of credit to the economy. And you can go down the list of facilities that the Fed, the ECB, Bank of England, for example, have put in place to reach different segment of capital market. Now, in terms of a broader response, so it's not just about monetary policy. Obviously, fiscal policy has been an important point. And I think the role of fiscal policy is crucial here in the sense that compare this crisis with 2007, 2008, there was a crisis that originated at the center of the financial system, was a financial shock, was about banks deleveraging. So the central bank intervention was about leaning against illiquidity. So making sure they would provide enough liquidity to the financial system so that they could prevent insolvency from emerging. So it was essentially leaning against illiquidity. This is a very different crisis. The world economy has come to a halt, essentially has gone into a coma. And so there's only so much a monetary policy itself can do. Monetary policy, of course, can provide a bridge to fiscal policy, but fiscal policy plays an important role here because now this is about solvency. And so solvency is something that only fiscal policy can address. It's not something a monetary policy on its own can address. And so if we think of response, of course, the first policy response is about protecting lives. We need a healthy economy. We cannot have that without healthy population. So that means essential containment measure, prioritizing health spending. That's obviously priority number one. The second priority, as I mentioned, is providing a lifeline for household and business. And that includes conventional and less conventional measures from cash transfer, credit guarantees, adjustment of term loans. They, of course, require a financial system that continues to function. This is where monetary stimulus and liquidity facility play a role. And then finally, the next step is going to be about planning for recovery. We need to make sure and reduce the risk of economic scarring to policy action that needs to place now. And so as the economy, the global economy stabilizes, coordinated fiscal policy would be important to boost demand and restore growth. Now, if you allow me one last thought about the role of the IMF here and what the IMF has done and what the IMF can do. We have taken a number of steps. We have doubled the IMF emergency rapid dispersing capacity to meet expected demand to about 100 billion. There's been reforming the so-called CCRT, so the catastrophe containment relief trust towards the poorest economy, the majority of which is in Africa, with the objective of raising 1.4 billion, aiming to triple concessional funding via the so-called PRGT, so the Poverty Reduction and Growth Trust, for most of the vulnerable countries, seeking 17 billion in new loans, supporting suspension of official bilateral debt repayments for the poorest countries through the end of 2020. And then finally, we establish a new short-term liquidity line to help countries strengthen economic stability and boost confidence.
Thank you for that, Fabio. Let me pose just a few simple questions to you. First of all, you've published chapter one of the GFSR. I think you indicated the rest will be out in May. Can you tell us what is in the other chapters and when we can look forward to seeing it?
Yes. So in the past, the GFSR, so if you look at the last GFSR, there were six chapters. They were all put down at the same time. I think there was an urgency here in the sense of getting out chapter one, which provided the broader overview of financial stability, risk and conditions, and then postpone what we essentially are deep dives into specific sector. I kind of mentioned already some of this, so there will be a chapter that is going to focus on risky segment of credit markets. So trying to put together the ecosystem essentially of global credit markets, the role played by banks versus non-banks, what kind of vulnerabilities we have seen emerging and building up over the last 10 years, how those compare with the vulnerability that became evident during the financial crisis. Think about different layer of leverage, for example, interaction of leverage with liquidity, and then come out with a number of possible policy proposals. So that's one chapter. Second chapter has to do with emerging markets. We do a deep dive into emerging markets, looking at portfolio flows, driver portfolio flows. And of course, emerging markets, it's a concern of us now. It's an important objective of the report. So there will be an entire chapter devoted to emerging markets. There will be another conjunctural chapter looking at profitability challenges for the banking sector. You can think of this as a mix between a conjunctural feeling to it, so looking essentially, obviously, what's going on now, and that's going to build on chapter one. But then also taking a little bit longer view, medium-term view, playing out what are the challenges that banks face, particularly in an environment when economic outlook may have deteriorated, not only now, but may take a while, essentially, to go back to the level of output where we were before the COVID-19 shock. What is the impact on low interest rate on profitability? So to get a sense of like what are the challenges going forward, look at differences across jurisdiction and what measure can banks take to address these challenges. And then finally, there would be a chapter on green finance. You can think of that as a more structural topic. It's less related to the crisis, obviously, but there is also a way to link it to the crisis in the sense that, as I mentioned before, the priorities number three is to think about the recovery. And I think as we think of the recovery, we need to think also what could be sustainable growth going forward. And green finance could become an important part of sustainable growth and reducing inequalities in the future.
Thank you for that. You commented here and there about the contrast between the speed of this crisis versus a global financial crisis. If you had any further reflections for us on that topic, I would welcome it. And let me pile on another question for you, which fits in nicely with something you just discussed, which is banks are so far weathering the storm. Much of that, I think, has to do with the measures we took after the global financial crisis, Basel III and the like. But as you've intimated, the recession could cause waves of bankruptcies, NPLs, deep economic scarring. I assume you feel the banks need to be vigilant, closely monitor their balance sheets. Do you think even more severe stress stress tests will be needed in the aftermath of the coronavirus crisis? And, you know, if you have any thoughts along the lines of U.S., European, and Chinese banks on that front, I'd appreciate them.
Yeah, so I touched upon on the tightening of financial condition. I think clearly the scale of the magnitude of the tightening, it's not as large, obviously, as we have seen during the financial crisis. But again, it occurred in a window of only 2 months. And that was what's in some sense striking, that 1.5-2 standard deviation became really a test of the resilience of the financial sector. I think some sector and some institution, maybe we can be confident after we have seen this. In other cases, I think some concern remain. So the fact, for example, that in the United States, the Fed had to jump in and backstop a number of segments of capital markets, of U.S. short-term funding markets, capital markets. If you think about the facility, we have a number of facilities that deal with short-term funding markets, as see that the commercial paper markets, they aim mutual funds, and then a number of they aim the primary dealer, use of discount window, and then a number of facilities that entirely bypass the financial intermediaries and reach the corporate bond market, for example, reach SMEs and even munis, right? So in some sense, I think we can take some comfort that the plumbing of the system didn't break despite the sharp tightening over these 2 months. But also there are concerns that, yet again, the central banks had to step in to provide support to different components of the plumbing to make sure to unclog some of this plumbing and also, in some cases, to entirely bypass with new pipe the final user. Perhaps this reflects in part the different nature of the shock. And again, this is not a financial shock. It's very hard to think about ex ante of a shock where the entire world economy comes to a complete halt. If I go back to October and talk about the trigger that we highlighted, of course, we did not have in mind a virus. This is an historical challenge, very hard to think about in advance. Entire economy completely come to a stop, complete collapse of trade. So on one hand, the system proved quite resilient. On the other hand, it needed quite a bit of help from the central bank. And so thinking about going forward, how to incorporate this lesson, I think it's going to be an important part. On the banks, I already mentioned that, of course, banks have more capital, more liquidity. They clearly benefited from the post-crisis financial regulatory reforms. Now, are they being stress tested for something like this, right? So this is a very unique shock. So we have a chart in the report where we compare the average GDP shock through the IMF FSAP, so the financial sector assessment programs, in advanced economies and emerging markets, and compare that with the shock in the WIO baseline and in one of the three WIO downside. Now, over a two-year horizon, the FSAP shock is pretty much in line with the WIO baseline, although the timing of the shock matters in the sense that the shock is very much more kind of V-shaped here, in the sense that the WIO baseline is a very large shock 2020 and then a recovery in 2021. So the shock in 2020 in the WIO baseline, it's much larger, especially for advanced economies, it's larger than what we had in the EFSAP. So the timing matters, not only the two-year resilience, but year one versus year two, I think it's something to keep in mind. When you start moving toward downside, and we only took the downside number one, which is essentially an extension of containment measure, and of the three downside is the less severe, you can see then that those numbers in terms of GDP shock start being quite larger compared even to the FSAP itself. And so, of course, banks are resilient and they have been able to absorb the shock so far, but should the economic outlook deteriorate more, and so instead of being the baseline, we move into one of the downside scenarios, and should financial condition tighten even more, then that would be a real test for the resilience of the financial system in the post-regulatory financial reform world.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Let me just ask you one last question. You talked a good bit about non-banks. In the U.S., talk about non-banks or market-based finance. Some in Europe call it shadow banking. But regardless, the post-global financial crisis financial regulatory agenda didn't tackle the non-banks as it did with the banks. As you discussed, the depths to which central banks have had to go to support markets went far beyond the GFC playbook. You've already indicated that non-banks were a factor in the severity. Do you think that policymakers over the last decade have underestimated the amount of leverage and maturity transformation and interconnectedness arising from non-banks, and that this worsened the virulence of the financial market fallout from the crisis? And if so, do you think there needs to be a major focus on non-banks and remedial actions?
The answer is a yes and yes, in the sense that, of course, the post-crisis regulatory reform agenda has been very much driven by what we learned 10 years ago. And so if you look and think about the FSB agenda, for example, it was based on what we learned, how the crisis unfolded and what transmission channel were and where action was needed. So center on the banks, again, more capital, better capital, more liquidity, resolution plan, thinking about too big to fail, CCPs, and I mentioned CCPs before, and market-based finance. I think on the market-based finance, more clearly this episode shows that more works need to be done. And I can take the credit markets and the chapter that's coming out as an example for this. Banks in risky segment of credit markets play a much, much more reduced role. So that, of course, helped the banks. It should help in terms of banks managing exposure and so on. The point is that sector has grown to $9 trillion globally post-crisis. With the banks playing a much bigger role, that means that other non-bank financial intermediaries have been playing a role here. And that's a very wide range of players. Includes insurance company, includes pension funds, structured products like collateralized loan obligations, includes hedge funds, includes international banks. Now, on one hand, the dispersion of risk is something that we always thought would be a plus. It would be help to lessen the shock. On the other hand, risk didn't go away. It went away essentially from the fortress of the financial system, which is banks, to the periphery of the financial system. The problem is, in some cases, we have less visibility than we would have if risk was staying with banks. So the one example I always offer in terms of data availability and visibility is the CLOs, right? So I was at the Fed 10 years ago. I was working on leveraged finance and CLOs. And the frustration was that it was very hard to come across data on who was holding the CLOs, not just the AAA, but also the lower tranches, how much was concentrated in the US, how much was global. And I think I can say that 10 plus years later, the quality of data is only marginally improved. So we still have limited visibility, limited data in some of this corner. There was an FSB report on this and make the same point. A big chunk of global leverage finance, leverage lending, in fact, it's under the others unknown. So to me, that's unacceptable. We should have the data. If you don't have data, you can't monitor. But also in terms of vulnerabilities, because risk has moved away, there are still vulnerabilities. Perhaps there is less leverage. So you can think of leverage in three layers. There is the layer at the corporation firms, and that leverage clearly increased, right? So leverage at sub-investment grade firms is higher than ever it was. Then there is the embedded leverage into structured finance. Think of CLOs, and the structure perhaps are safer than they were 10 years ago. And then there is the financial leverage layer on top. That layer, based on what we can understand in the data we have, it's limited compared to 10 years ago. But still, again, very limited data availability. Now, assuming that these three layers of leverage are now more limited than they were 3 years ago overall, then there is another vulnerability that's been arising, which is the risk of illiquidity, right? So provision of daily liquidity when the underlying are illiquid, role of ETFs. What are the interactions between leverage and illiquidity? You mentioned interdependence, interconnectedness. That could be an amplifier of the shock itself. It is true that maybe that they're more provider of credit, they're dispersed in the periphery, but if they're all interconnected themselves, that could be itself, by itself, a source of shock. So I think we need to do much more work to understand where the risks are, what the vulnerabilities are, how they interplay between themselves in terms of interconnectedness, whether they will come back to the banks from the back door. Have we fully consider all the possible contingent exposure of banks to the NBFI, to non-bank financial intermediaries. And then finally, if we come up with an assessment that risk, in fact, is higher, do we have the tools to address this? Do we have macroprudential tools to do this? And I think if I think of corporate debt, and when we say we should use macroprudential tools to lean against the buildup of vulnerabilities, I think sadly that the toolkit for addressing vulnerabilities in the non-bank financial intermediation and their provision of credit, I think that toolkit, it's quite limited. So definitely more work in terms of data, in terms of monitoring, and also setting up a proper toolkit.
Well, thank you for that. And I had written a piece that was in the Financial Times earlier this week urging the IMF and the FSB to work together on a study of these non-bank issues and propose remedial actions. And it sounds like you have your thinking cap already on. I welcome that. I thank you for today's discussion.